And now it's my privilege to introduce Danny Carroll, who I first got to know at North Park when he came and was a part of our symposium on the theological interpretation of Scripture. Danny comes from a bicultural background and has taught for 15 years in Guatemala and then about 15 years in Denver. So bicultural, bicontinental, there's a lot of interesting experience there. On the ride from the airport with Stan Wilson and myself, we discovered that he also was a varsity basketball player at Rice University back in the day. And I was just pleased earlier to notice that it's seldom that you see Roy Terry looking small. And as I was worshiping in the opening service and 6'4" Roy is standing behind Danny, he looked very small indeed. Danny's latest book, Christians at the Border, Immigration, the Church, and the Bible, is a biblical theological orientation to Hispanic immigration. He's been doing a lot of reflection on what it means to be a neighbor near, a neighbor far, on what immigration has to do with the Missio Dei. And so we're pleased that he's going to open us up with immigration and the Missio Dei implications for being the church. Please welcome Danny Carroll.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here. I don't really know what you all are about. In fact, during the coffee time, I was asking Craig Wong, tell me where I am and who these people are. And he really wasn't much of a help. But it is good to be here. I was thinking about, when I was listening to your sermon, there's another piece of language that I might throw out. Those of us who come from bicultural backgrounds, I'm half Guatemalan, I'll get to that in a moment, we have a heart language, you see. And one of the problems is, for Christians, we have different heart languages many times from what the scriptures tell us. If I want to romance my wife, I don't do it in English. I do it in Spanish. Es un idioma de romance, right? Un idioma de los ángeles. And at least we think so. And so I think one of the things that we need to do as Christians is somehow to make the scripture language our heart language. Because oftentimes our heart language is our cultural language. So anyway, that might be something to think about, is how do we make it not only how we can talk to another, but how it actually becomes the language of our romance and of our heart. Immigration. Let me express some thoughts on that. And I want to begin with a personal background and how I got into this. I'm 6'6", and I'm half Guatemalan, so that's kind of a contradiction in terms. My father was the son of Irish immigrants. My mother was Guatemalan. And she was 5'4", my father was 5'11", and my older brother is 5'6". So I have no idea how I ended up like I am. But we were raised bilingual and bicultural. I was born in Houston, and we would spend all our summers in Guatemala. I was telling them over coffee that by the time we were 10, we were flying to Guatemala, my brother and I, by ourselves, on the old Pan American Airlines, those of us who were older, the four-engine props, you know. I did that growing up. And we would spend our summers in Guatemala, and then as a young man, I felt odd because I was this tall by the time I was 15, and of course, that was very awkward in Guatemala. I never thought I'd ever go back, but as it turned out, I went back to teach for many, many years. I'm still adjunct in Guatemala. In fact, I fly out on Monday to Guatemala. But when I was growing up, my family in Houston, we had Guatemalan neighbors. It was my aunt and her husband and her family for 11 years. But my parents' friends in Houston were Cubans. There's a large Cuban population in Houston. And they're professionals. They're the ones who were able to leave when Fidel came in. And so my brother actually ended up marrying one of those Cubans. And I'd never really met the Hispanic population that we now talk about. I never thought of myself as different, maybe because I looked Anglo and everyone thought I was. It wasn't a problem. And our friends, you know, were Cubans and perfectly bilingual and professional. And then I went to teach in Latin America for many, many years. And it was when I came back to Denver that I began to engage the immigrant issue, and not because I wanted to. I didn't know what to do with U.S. Hispanics. When I came to Denver, many didn't speak Spanish, or I never met Hispanics that didn't speak Spanish. I've always been around Central Americans in Central America, and everyone speaks Spanish, because otherwise you can't eat or anything. And I've been around Cuban Americans who are beautifully bilingual, and so I've never met anyone like this before. Or the Spanglish. You know, I'd never, you know, they would say things, and I would go, what? You know, all these modismos that we say in Spanish that make no sense in proper Spanish, and so I didn't know what to do with all that, so I didn't do anything for a number of years. But then there was a Peruvian pastor in Denver that began to nag about starting a Hispanic program, a seminary, and after a couple of years of nagging, you know, we started one. And we now have about 150 Hispanics taking classes at a lay level, and basically they're all undocumented. And that's when I began to hear the stories. And I began to engage the Hispanic community on the ground, and I attend an Hispanic church in Denver. But what disturbed me was the fact that when I would have conversations with people who claimed to be Christians, that the immigration discussion wasn't a Christian discussion. It was about economics. It was about health care in the hospitals. It was about schools. And those were all important things, but there was nothing Christian about the conversation. And so that's how I got into this whole biblical piece. And I'm an Old Testament prof, so we'll be looking at some Old Testament things. But I actually want to begin with the New Testament scriptures. So even though I am Old Testament, I still do the New Testament occasionally. And there is this passage, which you would recognize in 1 Peter. And let me just read this to you, and you will recognize it. Let me just read the first part of the verse, 1 Peter 2:11. Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world. Now, if we are aliens and strangers, if the idea of being immigrants is a central metaphor of what it means to be a Christian, how does this inform our look at the immigration debate? See, if who they are in the flesh is who all Christians are in the spirit, how do we engage the topic? Could it be that people who are truly strangers and aliens have a deeper sense and an appreciation of what it means to be a Christian than those who are not? See, if this is the central metaphor, at least one of them, of what it means to be a follower of Jesus, how does this inform how we even look at this thing? And so I want to give some biblical thoughts about immigration and our identity as Christians. And then we'll have these discussions around the table and we'll see how it goes. The first thing is, immigration is what informs the Bible. The Bible is a book of migrating people. And let me just tell you stories. Maybe stories you haven't thought about before. Let me just kind of rehearse them for you. Abram, as you know, leaves Ur, right? The Chaldees, you've heard that phrase, right? Ancient Babylon. And he travels with his extended family to the northwest, to Haran, and then he'll come down into Canaan. And so the father of our faith, you know, the wandering Aramean, and that was mentioned earlier today, the father of our faith was a migrant. But there's an interesting thing that happens in Genesis chapter 12. Because not long after he gets to Canaan, there's famine in the land. You see, there's hunger. This is why people move. You see, they want food. And so they move, and it's not just extended family. It's, you know, he's the head of a clan. They go to the border of Egypt, and he tells his wife, you know, if I ask you, you tell them that, you're my sister. And we kind of, you know, kind of read that. Oh, it's a bad thing to do, right? It's very much a migration story, isn't it? You see, when you get to the border and you're hungry, you might need to lie to get across. You've got to feed your family. And if that means lying about your identity, you do it. There's more at stake than giving them your right name. And she's willing to do this. She's willing to put herself at risk so that people can eat. If you know immigrant stories, it's not that uncommon. Interesting story that, isn't it? Joseph, he's not a willing immigrant, but you know, everyone loves Joseph, and so they sell him. There's been great, you know, brotherly-sibling dynamics in that family. At least they didn't kill him. I mean, they wanted to, but, you know, one of them prevailed, and then they didn't, and they sell him. And he goes into Egypt, and, of course, he's a hard worker at Potiphar's house, and Potiphar puts him in the head of the household, and he's honest and a man of integrity, and then Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him, and of course he runs away. But when the authorities kind of come to grips with it, who do they blame, the immigrant or the Egyptian woman? Well, he's the one who goes to jail, of course. But he comes out, you know the story, and he comes into the court of the king, and he ends up marrying an Egyptian. He gets very assimilated. He marries an Egyptian, has Egyptian children. He speaks Egyptian. And when his brothers come, you see, they come asking for food again. And they don't recognize him. And I thought, that was always strange. I mean, I would always recognize my brother. And I mean, people say, well, you know, times change, years go by, and people look different. And I go, no, I'd recognize my brother. But you see, as an Egyptian of that status, he would have shaved everything and painted his face, would have had some kind of crown or a wig. He speaks Egyptian, of course, though he uses the ruse of an interpreter, but he understands what they say. He goes into the back. Remember the story, he weeps. Because he knows what they're saying. See, this is the immigrant who never forgot his mother tongue. And even though he's been many years in Egypt, in the heart of hearts, he's still the son of Abraham in his genes. And when I die, I'll take my bones back home. It's a good immigrant story, isn't it? El idioma del corazón. No cambio. Moses, right? The hybrid, cultural, disturbed, like all of us half-breeds. Grows up in the Egyptian court and tries to, you know, save one of his brethren. He messes that up and he runs away. And he goes to the well in Midian. And how do the women at the well look at him? Well, he's an Egyptian. Well, he is and he isn't, you see. And then when he does marry one of them and he gives his son the name Gershom, which means a stranger there, even as he names his children. Is this why he's afraid to go back? How good is his Hebrew? Is this why he asked for an interpreter, a brother who had not been raised among the Egyptians, but he had? You talk to those who were raised bilingually and some have lost one of the languages, and sometimes you're in conversations and they grope for the word in Spanish. Moses is an immigrant story. Have you thought about that one? Ruth is, you know, the classic. You see, Ruth marries an immigrant, you see. Naomi and her family, they go to Moab because there's famine in the land and the sons marry Moabite women, one of whom is Ruth. So Ruth marries an immigrant. See, but the father-in-law dies and her husband dies and the brother-in-law dies and now she goes back with Naomi and now she becomes the immigrant. And she tells her mother-in-law, you know, your God will be my God, and your people, my people. Wherever you go, I will go, and I will die there too. And if you read Ruth chapter 1, Naomi doesn't even respond, doesn't even say thank you. odd. They get to Bethlehem in Ruth chapter 1, and they all come out to greet Naomi, and Naomi doesn't even introduce Ruth. She's just part of the baggage. And the rest of the story is a woman desperately trying to feed herself and her mother-in-law and to be accepted, you see, by this little town of Bethlehem. She's trying to accommodate herself and assimilate into the culture. And when the workers are working there in chapter 2, and Boaz comes and says, "Who is that woman over there? I mean, she must be dressed funny or something. Who is that woman over there?" And they don't even know her name. Well, that's the Moabite. So she's been working really hard. See, this is how you recognize immigrants, isn't it? They work really hard. And she hasn't taken a break hardly all day. See, but by the end of the story, the elders of the town praise her and compare her to the great women of Israel. The women finally accept her, and they actually try to convince Naomi, you know, she loves you more than seven sons. And Naomi still says nothing. And they give Naomi the child. She takes it. Maybe now the mother-in-law accepts her foreign immigrant daughter-in-law. But I'm sure that son never had to go through what his mother had to go through in that town. The second generation immigrant, right? The son. Then the book ends with the genealogy of David. And this immigrant woman ends up being part of a story she never could have imagined. Now, there's more stories. We could talk about Daniel. That's a fun one. You know, Daniel, he's been taken away, and they give him a new name. That's what they were doing in the ancient world. It means I own you, and I'll give you a different name. So you're not going to be Jose anymore. You're going to be Joe. And we're going to educate you in the best of all the things that we know, and you will serve the empire. In fact, you were the best of the whole group, but, you know, they say, let us eat our own food. You ever thought about that as an immigrant thing? See, how do you recognize people? I mean, if you're in a part of town, how do you know what part of town you are in? Look at the restaurants. That's who you know is around there, because that's part of who we are. And I tell this story, and you know, Craig, you've heard this, and others who know me have too. I take students to Guatemala every year, but I take students from Denver every other year. And I tell them this: you better like black beans. I mean, it's like Forrest Gump and the Shrimp. Remember that scene? Right? So it's like, you know, we have black beans for breakfast, and we have black beans for lunch, and black beans for dinner, and we can do it any way you want. We can do it, you know, rice and beans. We can do, you know, volteados, which is, you kind of mash them up and it looks like a meatloaf. You can do bean soup. I mean, any way you want to bean, you know, bean sandwiches. We can do that, you know. We go to Chipotle, we can do it. And I said, okay. So about after about 3 days, Dr. Carroll, for the sake of God and His kingdom, can we have some American food, please? Outside the seminary gate, there is a Domino's. And then from the seminary, you know, a block away, but, you know, rising high into the sky, there is the Golden Arches. I mean, it's kind of mocking them, you see, is they? But I said, look, we'll do pizza night. I treat. That girl's great. But, yeah, I bring movies along. I know this always happens. And I, you know, I said, I'll get the pizza. See, what I don't tell them is, in Guatemala, we have black bean pizza. Have you thought of Daniel's an immigrant story? The people who are around don't like him. They like to humiliate him. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. Different levels of cultural adaptation. Ezra wants nothing to do with the Persians. I want to go home and set it up like it should be according to the letter of the law. Nehemiah is the cupbearer to the king. That's the last line of chapter 1. But if you know the story in chapter 1, he's waiting for news from home. You know, kind of an Univision thing, right? Even if he's committed to the court, he still wants news from home. And it's been generations in that time. And I was cupbearer to the king. Now, what a cupbearer is, the one who would try the food, right? Because in the ancient world, they were always trying to assassinate the kings. And so he would, you know, try the food. So chapter 2 is this great beginning. And the king saw that my face was sad. Now, if you're the king, the last thing you want to see on your cupbearer is a sad face. Real gay man, I mean, that food, how are we doing here? Oh, I just need to go home. Oh, I'll help you. But he wants to come back to serve his king. So he goes for a little bit, then comes back. Esther is actually a Persian. Esther is a Persian name. Hadassah is her Jewish name. She doesn't have a clue about her background. It doesn't mean anything to her until her relative, Mordecai, reminds her, maybe for such a time as this. And you see, the story of Esther, in part, is the story of an immigrant descendant going back to her roots and to her people. If you've been around immigrant second and third generations, this is what some of them go through. I don't know if you do, but some do. Hispanics taking Spanish in high school because they just can't quite say it right. Immigrant stories permeate the Bible. This is part of our heritage. I exhort you as aliens and strangers in the land. It's part of who we are, according to the scriptures. And maybe because immigrants live with God in ways that we don't, they get it. Because the scripture tells us we are strangers in a strange land. But what happens, and I would think this is part of what you do, though I'm still not sure what you do, is that this land has lost its strangeness. You kind of like it. In fact, we will kill to defend it. And we'll keep the strangers out of the strange land. Isn't that ironic? Interesting to think through what it means to be a Christian through an immigrant lens. Second piece. First piece is this is part of the story of the canon. The second piece is how we structure our communities, and this is where I go to Old Testament law. And Old Testament law is really massively understood. Now, we're New Testament Christians. We don't do the law thing, see? We're beyond that now. Well, you don't understand what the law is about. Because the law is not just about sacrifices and anticipating the cross, though, you know, that's one way of looking at part of the law. But the law is about what you eat, how you dress, how you cut your hair, how you raise your family, how you treat your animals, what you do with sick people, and what you do with people that rob and kill. Who can be king and who should be a judge, and who should not be in positions of leadership, and what is the ideology of the monarchy that will come? And so what the law is doing is setting up an alternative culture. You see, in the narrative, God takes them out of Egypt with all of their social construction of reality and all the religion that supports it and its ideology of the Pharaoh as God, and he pulls them out and takes them into the desert in the middle of nowhere and gives them another construct of reality based on a law that is deeply religious. You see, this will be an alternative world. And in our world, we won't treat people like they treated us. And in our world, our kings won't be Pharaoh. In our world, Yahweh is God and King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Law organizes life. I mean, you know, I live in Denver. We do right turns on red in Denver. You know, here they have signs that tell you you can't do that. And if you do, there's hell to pay. Or at least the city pay. And that's an interesting one, though, the whole traffic. And we organize our life around traffic. And we have all these rules. We have to learn kind of funny shapes and colors. You know, red means stop. I mean, who decided that? And yellow means slow down, and green means go. And we have triangle signs, and we have kind of, you know, amphibious landing shape signs looking thing, you know, octagonal. I don't know what they call those things. The stop signs, but I don't know how many signs those are. And so we have all these things, and we have to take tests. You have to get insurance, you know. But if you go to Latin America, you know, we have traffic laws. More flexible in here. It's more fun. You know, we have lines. They're helpful. But if it's 5 o'clock, it's economy of space. You know, we can fit more in here, we'll do that. And I tell the story, and it's really true. You know, we have stop signs and stop lights, and those are helpful too. Depending on what time of day it is and how much traffic is around. And, you know, if you come to a stoplight in Guatemala, it's like nighttime and no one's coming, why do you stop? That makes no sense. Just keep on going. You need to slow down just to make sure of it. And you come out of Denver Seminary, there's a stoplight. Sometimes I'm going to teach at night and it's, you know, late, I'm leaving my office, it's like 9:30, and there's a stoplight. And then nobody's coming. And I have two voices in my head. The Guatemalan's going, vamos. The American is going, they have cameras everywhere. You see, we organize our life around law. But different cultures understand law differently. It's part of the immigration, integration piece, is understanding how Americans think about law. And when I hear Americans say, well, you know, this is a country of law, the rule of law. And I go, well, every country is the rule of law, it's just a different law. We have law. You know, in England, they drive on the other side of the road. You know, you get a ticket for violating that if you're over there, right? And they organize, and they have their funny-shaped signs, and then the insurance and the police, you know, the big clubs and the funny heads, and, you know, we think that's cute, we take pictures, you know. But it's a social construction of reality that they have done. That's what you have in the law. But the thing that's key about the law is, and of any law, and I would say the law of this country and of our churches, a proof of the depth and the humanness of law, ancient church in U.S. or wherever, is what law does to the vulnerable people in our midst. What does the law say about poor people and widows and orphans, the vulnerable ones? Well, what does law do with foreigners and outsiders and immigrants? Because what it does with those helpless people is really a window into the heart and soul of the country. When you go into the Old Testament law, immigrants were vulnerable. They couldn't own land because they were from somewhere else, and land was done, you know, inherited through the male heirs, and of course they weren't part of that. Yeah, in the ancient world, they didn't have safety nets and a welfare system like we do, and so you depend on extended family, and that's what immigrants don't have. And so they were vulnerable, and they were dependent upon the Israelites for food and for work and for protection. And the law responds to all of this. It reveals the heart of God, which should be expressed in the heart of the people. What we do with immigrants says a lot about who we are as a church, who claim to be the people of God. This says a lot about this country. But then, as you go into the Old Testament law, you ask, well, why should we do this? And the law gives you two main reasons. And the first one is, don't you ever forget where you came from. Don't you ever forget what they did to us when we were strangers in that land, the forced labor, the abuse. And that's part of the problem with this country. We have historical amnesia. All we remember of our immigrant roots are the recipes. Right? Well, you know, Aunt Martha, you know, when it's Christmas time, she does the apple strudel. It's a family recipe. It's a secret. And Aunt Martha bemoans the fact that the younger generation is not remembering the recipe that's been in the family for years. You know, we're Austrian. Really, do you speak German? No, but we come from a royal family. Everyone in the genealogy comes from some royal family, right? And so we have St. Patrick's Day, right? Which remembers what? The Irish. So we all wear green and drink green beer. Right? And Oktoberfest, what's that? It's the Germans, and we drink beer. Right? And Columbus Day, what group is that? It's the Italians. Now, we kind of ruined the beer thing, and then it's red wine. But, you know, it's all about getting drunk and recipes. And that's the extent of our immigrant memories. Now you know why God said, don't you ever forget the socio-political and economic realities of our past. Because when you forget who you are and where you came from, you'll abuse the ones that come. And that's exactly what's happened in this country. We have forgotten it all. We have forgotten the Irish ghettos. We have forgotten the Italian enclaves. We've forgotten the WOPs without papers. And so they come and we abuse them. The very thing God said never to forget is exactly what we've forgotten. You see how important immigration is to our understanding of what it means to be a follower of God? The second reason is Deuteronomy 10. 17 to 19, God says, I love the stranger. And you will too. Why do we love the stranger? Because God does. What other reason do we need? And it says in Deuteronomy 10 that he gives them food and clothing. See, it's a concrete love of God toward the stranger. And how does God give them food and clothing? Through his people. This isn't kind of parachute from heaven. Uncomfortable, isn't it? Immigration is a litmus test of faith in God. I exhort you as strangers and aliens in the land. A third thing. Jesus. You know this. Jesus begins his life as a refugee. Goes to Egypt. How long he was there, we're not really sure. But did he speak Hebrew with an Egyptian accent? Well, who's the kid over there? He speaks kind of funny. I don't know. Did Mary learn some Egyptian recipes for birthdays? I don't know. But so, I mean, he lives the thing. Then he tells the story of the Good Samaritan. And that was part of what you do here this week, right? But have you read the question? What can I do to inherit eternal life? Don't you see the seriousness of the question? Then God, or Jesus says, well, you know, love God with all your heart and mind and all your strength, and you love your neighbor as yourself. And so the question comes back, well, who is my neighbor? But see, the bottom line is, how do we get eternal life? You love God and love your neighbor. So Jesus says, well, let me tell you a story. But the Samaritan. And see, the Jews and the Samaritans hated each other. They didn't like it. And there's history behind this. And you know the story. You know, the holy people pass by the man who's injured on the ground, right? The Samaritan goes by and picks him up and cleans him up. And you know the story, don't you? See, the Samaritan is the neighbor that's helping the one who's hurt. So then Jesus says, so who is the neighbor? And this Jew can't even bring himself to say the word Samaritan. He says, the guy who helped the other guy. See, the very people they hated was the people that Jesus used to show them what it means to be a true follower of God. It's the parable of the good Mexican. Kind of uncomfortable, isn't it? It's the story of Scripture. It's the heart of a community expressed in how it organizes itself, Old Testament law. It's Jesus engaging the Samaritans and telling us how we are to gain the very thing we desperately want. It means understanding, this is my last point, what it means to be a human being. You see, when I travel and speak on immigration, people always want to start in Romans 13. I go, no, let's start on page 1, chapter 1, Genesis 1. Let's begin at the beginning. The people made in the image of God, and all of what that means. We're created, he says, to rule the earth. To continue his work in creation by subduing it, by naming the animals, by taking care of the garden. We continue God's work. This is what it means to be human. We become his representatives on earth. And when you look at an immigrant, it's not only of how much value they have as people, it's the potential to be all of the things that God wanted them to be. All the things that God has equipped them to be. The Dream Act. Doesn't it make sense to you now? You facilitate, you channel, you open the door and let them be all that God has for them to be, for goodness sakes. How obvious is that as Christians? This is the hardest part. You see, going back to what Jesus said and linking it into what I'm closing with. If you were to go to Leviticus 19, that's where it says you are to love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus didn't come up with that line. It's in Leviticus. It's in the law. It's in the law. Leviticus, for goodness sakes, you mean Leviticus actually has something worthwhile to say? It does. Leviticus 19. Love your neighbor as yourself. If you go down in that same chapter to verses 33 and 34, it says, you will love the stranger as yourself. And what you see is that the hardest neighbor to love is the stranger. And in the very same chapter, it says, love your neighbor as yourself, love the stranger, love the alien, love the sojourner. That's the ultimate test of loving your neighbor, is loving someone from somewhere else because they're different. You see, now we're empowered with a different lens to begin to treat people as people made in the image of God. The gospel and the church permit us to be truly human. When I teach in Denver, I use this metaphor a lot. I was talking to Michael Buddy, and, you know, I think it's how you pronounce your last name. You know, being a prof's kind of good because we just drink coffee and read books, and they pay us to do this. It's actually a good life if you can get it. It's the grading papers that's the downer on it all, right? But so I wear glasses, and you know, it's gotten worse as I get older because you read books and drink coffee, but you know, you die content in a sense. But so some years ago, I've been wearing bifocals since high school. That was not cool. but anyway, a few years ago, you know, I started doing the computer thing like this, right? And so the doctor said, you know, maybe you have to move the trifocal thing. And so I said, well, and so he said, oh, we can just give you some computer glasses. I said, oh, let's do that. So for a couple of years, you know, I'd have regular like bifocals, and then I'd have computer glasses, right? So I was always doing this, and someone would knock on my door, and I'd go, okay. now I have the gradation, whatever they call it, you know, which the first few days it's kind of like, but now I can do this. But here's the point. This guy's really strange. Here's the point. This is key for this whole debate, and maybe it fits into this group, whoever you are. See, all of us, I can see 20 of you in this room without these. But even on the front row, you're kind of fuzzy. You know? I met you, and I know you have glasses. Right? But I'm not, you know, I can't see those, I just know that they're there. You know, I know you have hair, and others have less than others, but, you know, I can kind of see the thing on top, and, you know, nose and eyes and mouth, I can see something there, but I couldn't. I know the color of your shirts. But you see, I can see you. But now I see you clearly. Everyone out there sees the world. They live in it. They work in it. They raise their kids. The problem is, you can't see life clearly. This is the scripture, you see. This is our Christian faith. We see humans as they really are. We see life as it really is. That's why that is a strange place. And that's why I'm a citizen of another kingdom. I am a stranger in a strange land. As we and you think about what does it mean to be the church and what does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to live into our Christian faith? Put on the lens. I exhort you to do so as strangers and aliens in this land. Okay, I'm supposed to come up with some kind of question or something, aren't I? Does someone have a good question? you know, maybe just to kind of go on with what's going on here is how has the immigration debate or immigration experiences or immigrants you know, how they informed or should they inform your Christian faith? How's that?
Thanks, Danny. So we will start at the tables, and then we will pull the conversation back and run the mics. And ask Dan, you don't have to sort of stand here and watch. And in a sense, you'll get a little taste at that table, maybe what's happening around the room. So the focusing question that Danny has posed for us is, how has, I think you said the immigration debate, but if I could tap into some of your stuff a little more fully, you spoke about the need to recover a heart language that comes from Scripture and from our faith rather than from the cultural, the sort of national or economic or cultural language that's out there. And the sermon today also talked about learning to speak by learning to speak God's language. So, to just take that a little more fully, how have encounters with migrants or with sojourners or with strangers, how have those impacted your own congregational discipleship? How have they caused you to either recognize that you're speaking the culture's language instead of the church's language? Or how have they drawn the church's language for it? How have they driven you into the Old Testament narratives, the scriptural narratives, the scriptural law, the story of Jesus, this truth about God's, our humanity in God, or how should they draw us into that if they haven't? So that's the kind of first question. The other would be, how is God calling you as a church to live into strangeness? That's where you ended, and I don't want to lose that. So, I invite you to take at least 10 or 12 minutes to begin those conversations, and then we'll open it back up and let the folks interact with Danny. Go ahead. Recognizing that the Spirit will never give us all the tables of applause at the same moment, I'm going to invite folks to enter into conversation with Danny Carroll. And if you would raise your hand, I'll bring you this microphone and you can make sure that we can all hear what gets said. So is there a table or a person? Craig Wong, is that your hand up? Craig Wong? There we go.
One thing that was coming up at our table was the role of fear in immigration and that direct connection or challenge to our faith, the role of fear.
Am I supposed to make a comment? You know, the answer is yes. next question. No, I mean, that's true. I go to an Hispanic church, and in Metro Denver, certain communities, the police can act as immigration agents. In Aurora, where the church is, they can't. And so there was a man in our church where it was his son's birthday, it turned out, and he was driving his van, he's a roofer, and picked up a friend, giving him a ride, and the police just started following him, waiting for him to make a mistake. So they could pull him over, and it didn't. I mean, because you'll actually hear sermons about, you know, you don't hear this in Anglo congregations, you hear sermons about riding the speed limit. And they stopped him, pulled him over, and they took him. And in Denver, the detention centers are privately owned institutions, which some of them are, because it's big business. Government pays them per head per day. In Denver, they moved from a 400-bed facility to a 1,500-bed facility. And they were full, and so they shipped him to Colorado Springs. And, you know, when he was given the right to make a phone call, he called his wife and said, get the kids. They have three kids, two more. I'm just going to get the kids and leave. And I don't know if they'll come to the apartment. So eventually we were able to post bond and get him out, and he's been given some extensions. But you know, there is that fear. You know, they're the invisible population until we begin looking for them. But let me say this, and then I'll. The fear works both ways. Let me give you a biblical example. Go to Exodus chapter 1. What scares the Egyptians are the numbers. There is some kind of numerical threshold, if you remember the story, that scares them. And that's when they start putting in rules to hold the population under control and to control the size of the population, you know, kill the little boys. Well, you know, we're not bothered, you know, by Chinatown. Because that's circumscribed, there's a sign that tells you you're going in. And we're not bothered that the signs are in Chinese, and this is the best Chinese food, right? And I tell the story, you know, Matt's heard the story, but, you know, my son went to this college in Boston, and we went to visit him, and, you know, went to the Italian part, you know? And it was just, like, weird. I mean, guys sitting in wife beaters, you know, and, like, plastic chairs in the door, and they're kind of, oh, can I talk like this, you know? And it's like the set of the Sopranos or something, right? There's all great Italian food, and waiters are speaking Italian, and no one's bothered. We think it's kind of cute. We're taking pictures, you know, doing the bus tour in Chinatown. You see, it's a tourist attraction. But when you get the numbers, the fear is not only on the immigrant side, the fear is on the majority culture side. Fear of loss of culture. And so you see it in Exodus, where the majority culture now begins. And this is the odd part, if you remember the story. Even as they begin to try to eliminate part of the population, does this sound familiar? Even as they make it harder for them to make bricks, harder for them to work, they still want them to work. And that's the contradiction of the story, which is what we have in this country. See, we want to control the population, we want to make it harder for them to get jobs, but we still want them to cut our grass and to put on our roofs. And it's an exodus. The fear is on both sides. I can do more, but I don't want to.
When you talked about referencing Genesis and being all that people can be in their humanness. I often find that, or feel this tension of the only thing we kind of know to be all you can be is just that green line, be all you can be, which is the American dream, and not being an on-ramp to the kingdom of God, but an on-ramp to the American culture. And I don't know if you can speak to that, how to be a kingdom people, that you are not just paving the way to the best that our culture can offer, which isn't necessarily a kingdom of the best.
So this is what it means to be in this place, to ask these strange and hard questions. That's actually a very good question, because one of the things that you find in the Old Testament is the power of hope. And it's material hope. It's the hope of crops and wine to drink and children. And there's a great passage, and it describes the heaven and earth in Isaiah 65, beginning verse 17. And it talks about children being able to grow up and not die young. It talks about being able to build their homes and live in them without someone taking them away, the invasions. And human hopes are very concrete. Now, this is the problem, because when people come, they come looking for work, they come looking for food, they come looking... Some of them with a sense of adventure, if we're honest, if you know them. They didn't have to come, but they wanted to come because they were told. And there's this family from Colombia in our church in Denver, and they worked their way up the isthmus from Colombia. It took them 4 years to work their way up. Undocumented. And he's a janitor. And he told me, you know, it's not what they told us it would be. And now I can't go back. So you're right. I mean, it's not only reorienting the host culture, it's reorienting the immigrant culture. And the thing that I find is that sometimes activists on the Anglo side will tend to idealize immigrants. Well, their sin is just like all of us. Got to end with them. I mean, they're as messed up in their families. And, you know, I mean, so, yeah, it's detoxifying those who defend this strange man. It's detoxifying those who have given their life to try to get to this strange land. You're right. I mean, it's really a multi-level, multi-dimensional detoxification process. What it means to be a Christian and all of these things. The thing that's interesting about the Hispanic church is that in Latin culture, you know, familia is, right? And in this Anglo culture, it's not. You know, I hear people, well, I can't wait for the kids who are 18 to leave the house. And you're like, I'm going, why would you want that? But that's, you know, like, I'd be on their own, you know, self-sufficient. The American thing, right? I'm just like, I want my children. See? So what you find in Hispanic congregations is that the church becomes the extended family. Because, you know, Guatemala, on Sundays, what do? You go to your grandmother's house. Everybody does. So you're all kind of eating together on Sunday afternoons. Well, in the States, then, the extended family becomes the church. And that's what you'll find oftentimes. They all stay after service and have a potluck dinner or a lunch. So part of the detoxifying process is actually going on out of cultural and familial survival. I don't know if they process that theologically, but they're actually living out some detoxification as they come together in the community.
Hi. My name's Matt. Question about how a Christian identifies him or herself as an immigrant in the First Peter sense, one who is in the bottom, or the role of power disparity and social relations. And simultaneously, as I mentioned, the law, like the Dream Act, in favor of the so you configure your identity towards a powerless one.
Am I tying up? Yeah. No, I'm not talking about it. This is precisely the point in the Old Testament. The Old Testament is this give and take between outsiders and insiders. An uncomfortableness that you find in Ezra and Nehemiah with intermarriage, for instance. With the law making demands that they allow them in, even as there are some laws that lead to exclusion. It is leaving in Exodus 12 as a mixed multitude. They're not a pure race when they leave. And what you find in the story of the Old Testament is this tension between being particular in one people and being a universal people. Okay? So if you have this historical experience throughout the Old Testament going on, it's a very uncomfortable experience because it's a human experience. You see it going on within the laws themselves, which is, look at U.S. law, you know, there is the myth of the welcoming country and the, you know, Statue of Liberty and all this stuff. The irony of it all, the same decade we put up the Statue of Liberty and welcomes the immigrants, the same decade we passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. I mean, it's the contradiction. So, you know, what I would say is that we speak into this in all of our humanness and all this complexity. And the thing that's interesting is, and this is where we have to understand that law shapes people's morals and worldview. That's why it is imperative we work on law. And that's what I try to communicate a little bit in my law piece. You know, so that's why we're obligated to defend and to speak up for the immigrant, even if we don't totally understand. But I think one of the things that God demands of his people, and I think this is where the New Testament comes in, we can't really be who we really are unless we engage immigrants. They are who we are supposed to be. So even as we speak to them and for them, we have to realize, this is another thing I found an activist, one thing on the Miss You Day is to make immigrants the target. We're doing this for you. Well, okay, that's part of it, but don't you understand, we can't even understand Miss You Day unless you work on us. And so the Miss You Day becomes truly a communal enterprise, not a target audience, even as we think we're self-righteously speaking to the greater culture. I mean, it's a more complex Miss You Day.
It's going to be the last and brief question.
Yeah, and thank you. Your last comment just kind of addressed what I was thinking about. Probably a lot of people have had experiences, whether it's volunteering in soup kitchens or food banks, and there's always a sense of, I'm going to do something for you, give me your box of food or whatever, and then you're going to go on your way and be out of my life, and I don't have to be in your life. And with me, that over the years have been involved with these kind of things, that's kind of been troubling. How can we more get on equal footing to have people in our lives so we see each other as peers more than a project? And then kind of talking about it.
Yeah, and that's really context specific. I mean, like the church I go to, it's an ED free church. And so there's a Anglo community in the morning, and in the afternoon it's Filipino and Hispanic and Korean and African. So like four different churches meeting in the afternoon, different parts of the building. And so what the mother church tries to do is once a quarter everyone come together for a worship service. And so even if they can't speak Spanish, you can at least sing songs together. So, some churches do meals. I mean. It's almost an individual person, individual church thing. But I think it's a change in mindset. I mean, that's why I began with the 1 Peter 2 passage, because if we begin with the idea, they really get it, because for most of us, the stranger and alien thing is a metaphor. That's all it ever will be. For them, it's a lived experience. And so they're working at it, not only a metaphor, they're working at it in life. And so we need them to tell us what the metaphor means. So then the question becomes, if that's the truth, So how can I engage them for my sake and not for their sake? And it changes the whole kind of discussion that we have.
Join me in thanking